Checkerfin.
Fordham is always in my head.
Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Yes.
It's the education gadfly.
Sex,
sex. Mike and Rick tell you
early college, high school, pain and suffering,
learning and teaching.
In your face, in your face,
your
face.
Listen to your words that they be preaching. Cause here's the education gadfly show. Yeah.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, a man who was up late Tuesday night, Rick S.
Hey, Mike, how you doing,
man? I'm doing well. How you doing, man?
Doing good. I got big news. Jolene just won her first courtroom trial. So
that's fantastic.
A lot of excitement around Shea Carlisle.
Wow, fiance Jolene. Very Woo-hoo. Good. Does this mean come with a big bonus or something?
I don't think so, but probably
performance pay?
Probably it's... You know, but performance pay implications, I think your clients are much less likely to be really ticked off at you and much less likely to kind of call for your job. So it is that whole, if you perform, everybody's nice to you kind of thing.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Well, that's great. Now, let me ask you this. Are you excited that this campaign is going to keep on going for a couple more weeks or months? Or are you ready for this thing to be done?
I got two words on that.
What's that?
Guilford County, baby.
Oh, very interesting.
And how about yourself?
As a political junkie, it's kind of fun to watch this keep going on. But at the same time, I like things to be tidy. And right now, things don't feel very tidy.
They are not tidy.
Yes, so I am torn.
But I hear you're starting to work the back rooms in your inimitable Petrilli way, pushing a particular shaping of the Republican cabinet downstream. Is this true?
No, it's not true.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. My sources are bad.
Your sources are bad. I mean, let's face it. I think still it's fairly unlikely that there's going to be a Republican administration come 2009, you would think, right? I mean, all the signs are against it. So.
On the political markets right now, I think Republicans are selling about 41 cents on the dollar. So Democrats are favored.
All right. Well, we have a lot to cover today, Rick, because we have a new feature to bring to our listeners. It is called Jeff Cooner's Education Outrage of the Week.
Guilford County, baby. That is highly Guilford County.
That is highly Guilford County. So people have to look forward to this. This is Jeff Cooner, our newish communications director at Fordham. Used to be at the Washington Times, and he has some information for us that's going to make us outraged, Rick.
Oof.
Outraged. Oof. Yeah.
Kind of get the spleen working, huh?
We also have one of your own research assistants joining us here in the show, taking the place of Christina, who's getting ready for a big event we're doing right now. Would you like to introduce Thomas to the listeners?
Listeners? We are presenting you with Thomas Gift.
Thank you, Rick. It's really a pleasure to be here.
I mean, Rick, it's clear that it is a pleasure for him. I mean, he's beaming.
Well, it is. I'm excited. I mean, this is a long time dream come true. It really is.
And I got to say...
Wait, hold on. A long time. I mean, we've been on the air for, what, 2 years?
It's a 2-year-long dream.
Well,
it's all relative.
When you're young. That's true. When you're young. You know, if you think that Thomas is like 22, 23, he's only been kind of cognizant for 20 years. Mm-hmm. 2 years is 10% of his life.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we're glad to have you here, Thomas. Why don't we go ahead and get started with Pardon the Gadfly.
Guilford County, baby.
The British government is trying to get rid of selective grammar schools, which require pupils to pass an entrance examination before enrolling. Gordon Brown's Labour government wants to scrap the exams and replace them with a lottery. They are doing this to increase equity. Mike, is this a good idea?
No, Thomas, it is not a good idea. Nicely done. That was very nice.
Thanks. I'm just getting warmed up here.
Yeah. So what we're talking about here are selective public schools. Think of Thomas Jefferson High School in Northern Virginia, for example, or Stuyvesant in New York City, some of the other ones around the country. Most big cities have some sort of elite selective public high school, and they serve an important purpose, which is to make sure that even public school kids from all walks of life, no matter how rich or poor, have access to a high school that can really challenge them and prepare them for college, just like some of the best private schools in this country do. It seems like these are great institutions. I don't know why the government has decided that they're going to go after them. I don't see how it helps the cause of equity if poor kids don't have access to these kinds of challenging high schools that rich kids can through private schools.
Well, I mean, I guess there's at least two wrinkles here, right? One, in the States, the charter community has made it a selling point that they are opposed to these kinds of selection mechanisms on the front end. So, which is kind of neither here nor there, but we've certainly many of the reformers have made it a point of opposing these kinds of elite institutions. Right. And second, you know, the reality is that your Thomas Jefferson's Northern Virginia, your Bronx School of the Science, These are hardly representative institutions. I mean, if you look at the demographics on these kids disproportionately come from educated, higher-income families. So isn't the critique that actually it's a case of cream-skimming kids, teachers, and piling resources into schools that are providing additional advantages to the advantaged?
Well, you can make that argument, but I'm sure that they also include some poor kids and plenty of minority students as well. It gives them an opportunity. And the question is, should the public education system just be about helping, you know, kids at the very bottom of the performance spectrum or in the middle, or is it okay to help kids who are high achievers too?
If framed that way, I absolutely agree with you. That's mm-hmm. right.
I would just finally say that it does appear that we keep hearing news out of Britain that I feel like they're going after Tony Blair's education reforms and really starting to erode them, which is something that we will watch.
You know what else is interesting? There's Gordon Brown's numbers have just gone in the tank. Well, you know, last summer he was his numbers were something like 35 or 40 to about 15% negative, and his positives pretty much held, but his negatives have gone up 35 or 40 points in 6 months.
Well, I think
unprecedented.
Liam, Kobe, we should probably write an op-ed claiming that is entirely due to his education policies.
Although first you should probably check to make sure he is actually rolling back the Blairite reforms.
Yeah. That's a good point. Okay, Thomas,
all right.
Second question.
Supposedly, D.C. parents were up in arms about Michelle Rhee's plans to close 23 under-enrolled public schools. Former mayor and current councilman Marion Barry organized a rally to protest and ended up talking to himself. Michelle Rhee organized meetings around the city to address parental concerns about the closings, and she ended up talking to herself, too. Does this show that D.C. parents support the school shutdowns or that D.C. parents are just an apathetic bunch?
Well, first, I'm a little concerned about the amount of time the leadership is spending talking just to themselves. I'm a little worried about the implications. No, but okay, that wasn't very funny, but I tried. You know, this is another big victory for Michelle Rhee. I go out of town for a week. When I leave town, Miriam Barry is making all kinds of noises about how he wants to fight this thing tooth and nail. 6 days later, he is rolled over and is praising it and is praising Fenty and is praising Rhee for their leadership. So I don't know what Fenty and Rhee pulled out, if they just intimidated him, if a smart deal was cut. But, you know, you could not have gotten even odds 4 months ago that Rhee and Fenty were going to actually be able to shut down 24 schools in the course of a given school year. You know, previous Superintendent Janey's plan was to try to gradually close down about a dozen or 15 schools over a 10-year window. Mm-hmm. So this is just, you know, a case of the bold kind of, you know, really pushing the ball downfield. And yet, you know, hopefully it shows that DC parents are actually making sensible choices, that while there's obviously attractions to trying to defend your neighborhood schools, why people like to have schools open close, and while they like the schools that, you know, that are familiar, it doesn't do anybody any good to be wasting resources trying to maintain and operate a whole bunch of half open empty schools.
But Rick, you know, Can't you make the argument that now that 25% of the district's kids are in charter schools, these are parents that have gone out and chosen new schools to send their kids to, that the parents who are left in the D.C. public schools might be rather apathetic? I mean, they just might not be paying a whole lot of attention. If they had, maybe they would have chosen a charter school.
Yeah, sure you can make that argument. In fact, charter critics have been making it for 15 years now. The evidence on that, I think, is, you know, ambiguous at best.
The president released his 2009 budget. Even though it's dead on arrival, it contains some good stuff on the education front. $300 million for Pell Grants for Kids, for example. It also reinstates funding for Reading First. Rick, will any of this happen?
Well, since it's dead on arrival, no.
Yeah, I think we gave that away there in the description. I don't know. What do you think, Rick, though? Is any of this consequential? I mean, the president lays out his priorities. There's some pretty good ideas here.
Yeah, these are good ideas. These are ideas, though, that they needed to fight for in 01 and 02 when they were pushing on education. The Pell Grant for Kids is not dissimilar to the voucher proposal that they traded away early in the, you know, 2001 negotiations on NCLB. Traded away because they didn't have the votes, but still, that was the time to dig the fight.
Well, let me ask you about this. The Pell Grant for Kids proposal is basically has been marketed as a way to save faith-based inner-city schools, a.k.a. Catholic schools, which is a bit of a novel argument to just come right out and admit that, hey, we've got these great American institutions called Catholic schools, they're dying and we should do something to save them. That's a bit of a different argument than the typical voucher argument, which is about social justice and choice. And I mean, do you think this is a winnable argument to just say, hey, let's save the Catholic schools?
I mean, I think on the merits, I think if you had more, you know, I mean, it's an interesting political calculation, right? I mean, this is not a good smart Congress to try to propose this. They would have been much better proposing that argument, you know, in any of the previous Congresses. Partly it strikes me that there's got to be a calculation that you're Democrats from the urban Catholic districts, you know, that your folks out of New York and the Chicagos and the Philadelphias, that you can peel off some of those votes and get this done. I have a hard time imagining that they'll be able to sell that right now to the Democratic caucus, especially with the election approaching. But, you know, I suppose it's conceivable.
Well, all press reports show that there's opposition, not just from the Democrats, but on the Republican side.
Yeah.
Well.
I mean, do you see any scenario where this thing has any chance?
No, I don't. No, but I am encouraged that they are going to have a big summit on saving faith-based inner city schools later this spring, and that might bring some good attention to this issue. Because I don't think that the solutions are going to necessarily come from Washington.
Because these summits are always so effective, or?
Well, look, they sometimes can get people to the table who wouldn't otherwise be there. They might inspire some billionaire to open up his pockets to do something on this front. So, you know, it's better than nothing. It's better than nothing. And speaking of better than nothing, Rick, we have Jeff Kuhner with us here today.
Oh!
Ouch!
Sweet segue, baby.
What do you think about that, Jeff?
That was smooth, man. That was smooth.
Welcome to the show. All right, Jeff. Well, this is going to be a regular feature here on the podcast. Jeff Kuhner's Education Outrage of the Week. Jeff, tell us what you are outraged about this week.
Well, Mike, we're hoping to make this a regular weekly feature. The big outrage of the week is what's going on in New York City. My sources up in New York are telling me that there is an academy up there called the Khalil Gibran International Academy. It is based in Brooklyn. It was given a green light by the State Department of Education last year to be really the city's first major Arabic language public school. Now, remember, this is a public school financed by public dollars. So far, so good. I think a lot of Americans, myself included, have no problem with an Arabic language school. It will teach Arabic, you know, language courses, culture courses, as long as the U.S. curriculum, you know, core curriculum issues like geography, history, the sciences, English are being taught.
In fact, we have a great need in this country for Arabic speakers.
Exactly. I mean, right. Whether you're for the war in Iraq or against the war in Iraq or what you think about our dependence on foreign oil, we will be engaged and involved in the Middle East for literally decades to come. And so knowing Arabic is very important. So,
Jeff, you don't seem very outraged yet.
I'm not. I mean, I think so far the idea is a good one. The problem, however, and here's where the outrage
comes in. Oh, I smell outrage coming, baby.
Is that my sources are telling me that there has been some radical Islamic ideology and statements that are being made in the classroom to students. We found out that a lot of the textbooks have been sponsored and bought and paid for by the Saudi government. These are textbooks that contain all kinds of statements such as comparing Jews and Christians to quote-unquote pigs and monkeys. You have people in those textbooks saying that the great Muslim military leader of the Middle Ages, Saladin, or Saladin as we'd say in this country, the man who beat back the Christian invaders, is compared to Osama bin Laden. And so this is the kind of vitriol that you see in radical madrasas across Pakistan, Afghanistan, the Middle East, and frankly, even in some places in Europe. And it has absolutely no place in our classrooms in New York. And so what's been happening is there is a growing coalition of people opposed to this school, not to the school's mission, but to its political religious agenda. And the point that they're making, and it's one that I completely agree with, is violence and hatred has no place in America's classrooms. If these radical imams want to spread their hate in Pakistan or Afghanistan or Iran, that's their business. But not here. Not on American soil, not in American culture, not here, and certainly not after 9/11. And so what these opponents are now urging is that the State Department of Education conduct really basically an audit to look at the documents, look at the school's curriculum, and see exactly what's going on. Now, this being New York City, you think this would be a common sense proposal. Well, if there's hate being taught to our students, we should find out. No, the minute the opponents came out with the press conference on City Hall on Monday, there is the PC police showing up denouncing these people as bigoted and racist. And my question to these PC people is a very simple one. Since when did it become bigoted and racist to say that taxpayer dollars should not be used to finance hatred of the United States, hatred of Jews, and hatred of non-Muslims in our schools? And so, you know, I think it's high time, if we are in a war on terror, and I do believe we are in a war on terror, that we say our schools are front lines in the war on terror. And the one thing we want from our schools is that we don't fan the flames of global jihad, as you're seeing in madrasas around the world. So Khalil Gibran is a great school. You want to teach Arabic language, you want to teach Arabic culture, fantastic. You want to teach hate and intolerance and jihad, send it somewhere else. And so my advice to the opponents of this school is keep at it. And I think you're going to see the State Department of Education conduct an investigation. And if they do find out these allegations are true, and I suspect they are, then I think some administrators and teachers need to be fired, and quickly.
Well, I think we got our outrage.
There we go.
Whew, thank you, Jeff. My Rick, what do you think about all this? I mean, this is kind of the Achilles heel of the choice movement, isn't it? About, you know, once you allow schools to differentiate themselves, how far does it go? How do you regulate it? Who says, you know, something is Arabic culture versus something is jihad? I mean, what do you think?
No, these are great questions. And they don't just apply, obviously, in the choice movement. You know, Coalition for Essential Schools has long been asking big questions like, you know, is it okay? Was it okay for the U.S. to go to war in the Middle East? And obviously, this creates lots of room for administrators and teachers to bring political agendas to bear in the nation's classrooms, depending on the texts they choose, the lessons they teach.
All right, Jeff. Well, thanks for joining us. And I hope you can go, I don't know, do some meditation or something to calm down and relax.
I'm going to have myself a nice glass of water and just cool down a little bit.
I think that's a good idea. All right, Jeff Kooner with his Education Outrage of the Week. Well, now that we've got you all worked up, it is time for that cooler special time, the time that we wait for all week long, education news of the weird time, with our special correspondent Liam Julian. Liam, what's weird this week?
First of all, I'm upset that now I have to follow Kooner. I mean, this is going to do me in, you know.
Liam, I want you to know that Greg Toppo, USA Today education reporter, had lunch today with Checker, and he mentioned to Checker that he not only does he love the podcast, thank you, Greg, for that, but that his favorite part of the podcast, Education News of the Weird.
And I'd say that's widespread. I don't think that's unique to Greg.
Let's face it. We suspect a lot of you all are fast-forwarding through the rest of the
year. We do set a low bar, admittedly. It's also, you know, the days when Liam doesn't come in kind of droopy and morose and he brings it, it's some high-quality podcasting, baby.
That's right. And now that Jeff is here to raise the bar, since we were clearly incapable of doing so, that's going to just force Liam to be on his game.
Raise his game. We believe in competition.
All right, Liam, so what is weird this week?
All right, here we go. John Corcoran taught in California's Oceanside Unified School District for 17 years and didn't know how to read. Corcoran says...
This should be an education outrage of the week.
It could be, can be both, like a blend, a hybrid. Corcoran says that at, quote, 48 years old, I had already graduated from college, taught school for 17 years in California, and I couldn't read or write or spell my native language of English, unquote. In his student and teaching days, Corcoran stole tests and bribed friends in order to survive. Even though he couldn't read, Corcoran says he could, quote, read people and, quote, read the system, unquote. This spring, Corcoran, who is 70, will publish his second book. I don't know who's writing them. Titled Bridge to Literacy, No Child or Adult Left Behind. In it, he heaps praise upon the Reading First program.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Which he said, quote, prescribes what we need to do, unquote. Rick, who is your worst K-12 teacher and why? And that's Education News of the Weird.
So, Rick, any of your teaching colleagues, did you ever wonder, boy, I wonder if this person can read?
I did.
Seriously?
Yes.
I was kidding with that.
No. Both Baton Rouge and Boston. I think I certainly had moments when I would have gone,
Uh-huh. Well, wasn't it your responsibility to bring that concern to the proper officials?
Clearly, Mike, you never actually practice in the class because you would know the response one gets to that kind of useful feedback.
No, I only did my student teaching in a school where the kids called me Mike.
I like that.
Yeah, it was a very progressive school. The problem was I looked younger than most of the students. And, so that particular feature of the school didn't work well for me. All right. Well, that is all the time we have for this week. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you for Thomas, for Jeff. Liam, you brought your game. That's fantastic.
Producer A game, Cody. Baby. You know what we say when somebody brings their A game like that?
What's that? What
are we Guilford saying? County, baby.
Guilford County. All right. Thank you. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.